So I think we'll start with the panel on nation and hand over to the three of you.
Great. Well, we've arranged a little bit, but not entirely, who's doing what. So we arranged that I start. So welcome from the fog of PIMS to the fog of war, unfortunately. So we have here three books, two contemporary histories and one on the early Soviet period in Central Asia. These are all books that take for granted that you are quite familiar with the material in some sense, with the basic timeline at least. So I would say these are not books for beginners. And they do build on at least a slim corpus of knowledge. So I speak here as an anthropologist, not as a historian, and also not a specialist on the Persian Central Asia. These were all really big, rich meals of the book. Look at them. Maybe we'll pass them around.
Sorry.
No, I would like to thank the authors for reading them, and I actually found myself, considering the timeline, wishing I had more time to digest the detail. Yeah, this was really books that made me want more, so that is a really good sign. So, I'll give a short summary and then a commentary on each of them, and a few points of critique and comparison at the end. Could you keep me to time? I think that might be an issue.
We have like almost an hour, so that's don't worry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So Timothy Noonan's book. It looks like a fairly slim book, but actually it isn't. It's really packed. It takes us in particular through the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Afghanistan, and he calls it a global history of a country and asks what that is. It's a history of international development and humanitarianism in Afghanistan, so it's not exactly a history of Soviet invasion and occupation per se. And it's a history of sovereignty seen through foreign eyes, through youth advisors, women's activists, agronomists, Tajik translators. It's a story that goes beyond the Cold War archives into NGOs, universities, businesses, in particular to the archives and interviews with Médecins Sans Frontières and SDC, a Swedish NGO. And Timothy.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
In this panel, okay.
I insist on this because I'm.
You are. And Timothy describes this era or the maelstrom that that emerged as a battleground of the relationship of the global left to the third world nation state. On the one hand, Soviet-style territorial authoritarianism versus post-state humanitarianism. And I quote, he says, "The new Soviet global project destroyed states within borders. And humanitarian actors, on the other hand, cross borders in order to challenge illiberal state functions altogether." And so Timothy is really working with a spatial lens here, sort of describing the claws that tried to grip a pulsating, kind of slippery animal, and the process really made it bleed. And what we get is a kind of grill of ideas that are very sort of, they're filigree, but they are of steel. Yeah, and so that in a sense, this is a history of the power of ideas plus the geopolitical of interests in Pakistan that conspired to destroy a place and many, many people. And one of the effect that he describes is a borderscape of denial, a landscape in which things happen that aren't supposed to be happening, which creates legal aporias for Afghan citizens and the possibility of abandonment if it's no longer if there's no longer even a hidden kind of sense of obligation or possibility of intervening or leaving well alone. And that was a situation in which between the clash of these global projects that allowed Pakistan to exploit those ambiguities and to create the 1990s, really, in Afghanistan. So, Timothy identifies territoriality as a principle that none of the actors could actually see beyond as a major problem. And actually, I found that was something I would have liked you to elaborate on more, to be more explicit about what that meant. This is a book that is quite theoretical, but it is so in narrative style. Yeah, so the literature review is entirely in the footnotes, really. And I think this is also maybe for readership that is not exactly me, but on the other hand, it made me want more of that. So I think maybe from your both perspectives, you could explain the problematic of territoriality in this particular context in more detail. Yeah. And you argue that understanding the attempt and the effect of Soviet activities in Afghanistan actually helps us not understand what happened, but also the current conceptual vocabulary of development. So, for example, the history of Médecins Sans Frontières, how the idea of witnessing came about, and the rise of bodily trauma as evidence. So this is also a political history of aid. And there are also histories within this history, for example, a history of the Komsomol activities in Afghanistan, the making of Pakistan, how the hell to understand what a Pashtun is. This is a really key moment, especially in the early and then the very late sort of period that you cover, and how these sort of global projects and convictions intersect with childhoods, Afghan childhoods that were displaced, for example, in particular to the Soviet Union, or internally displaced, that were seen as both investments in saving these children, but also in shaping them. So you have a lot of very pithy sentences and adjectives, and one of them is the Afghan child who had symbolized humanity had grown to become a permanent dependent at best and a murderer at worst. This is also a history of Afghan feminism, and this is a point where all three books touch on women as a symbol that we might maybe talk about in comparison that might be worthwhile. And what I also I found very valuable, and I've not seen in this way before, is how you valued Russian scholarship on Afghanistan in particular. You mentioned this in the discussion yesterday, and I really saw this work through in the book. And that is a first for me in this way, actually, in English language scholarship. A couple of points of critique that I would like to raise, and these are just things that I would like to become more clear about. You talk about Afghanistan as a test site, and that is a very instrumental way of putting things, right? So it I know you don't mean conspiracy theories, right? Or top-down, master plan for Afghanistan. But what kind of stake, what kind of ideology does test this site? Yeah? So if this is a test site, what exactly does that mean? And this test site thing has been said about a lot of places. So is everywhere, the whole of Africa a test site? Or, what does it mean? And then there are some terms that I didn't become entirely clear about. You talk about the glacial modernization, which is a wonderful word, particularly on behalf of the Kabuli elite. And you talk, you critique the idea of failed states, and you suggest the idea of failed planets instead in the last section of the book. And that was also something that I would have liked to have explained more to me as the reader I am, who's not as educated as I'm sure I could be. So I'd like to turn to Tim Epkinhans now. It's also going round, I think. This book is really remarkable, in particular in the use of its sources, particularly 25, I think, all Tajik language accounts, right?
One is mixed. He uses it as a diary. Yeah. 500 pages of Russian as well.
Yeah, 500 pages of Russian?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the one is 900 pages, and then there's this three volume, which is in total 2,000 something pages.
Yeah, gosh.
It's enough.
Yeah. So these are all accounts by prominent actors in the events of the Civil War, in its prehistory as well, and you conducted a lot of conversations as well. And this is a really careful exercise in correlating the evidence. So you critique your sources, but you also manage to use them in a way, even when, as you say, they're extremely defamatory and they are all positioned and they're all, of course, defensive and righteous. And what you tell even more than Timothy's book, I think, is a story of cruel contingency of the fact that Rahman is in power now rather than someone else in Tajikistan. And I have to say, I don't know if this is an achievement or not, but I really started to hate those guys. Like the spineless Nabiyev, the personal animosities, the acid of defamation, the really the banal interests that were key to creating that particular vortex. It's different, but you engage really closely with what we would call local scholarship. So, you know, or with a range of sources that, again, I haven't seen in that way. And it's different from what Timothy is doing, right? Also linguistically, but at the same time, there's a real engagement there. And one of your main arguments is that this idea of regionalism as the cause of civil war is actually nothing but an ordering device in the same way as ethnicity is, not a cause for the war. In fact, this is contingency, conjunction of massive economic crisis, bad leadership, weak institutions, that nobody realized that if you have democracy, it just doesn't mean just freedom, but is a structured freedom of sorts, and an intellectual moment, a post-colonial moment in the mid-1980s that actually became extremely splintering, right? And disorientating. So around the questions, what is Islam to us? What language for whom? What is our relationship to the Soviet Union? Those were the kind of some of the splintering moments. And you are also writing against the idea of foreign conspiracies as a cause for the war. Along the way, we learned really interesting things, just like in Timothy's book, for example, about intersecting concepts of masculinity that bred violence. Like you have this case study of the warlords. Is it okay if I call them warlords? Hafar?
As you like, yeah.
What do you call them?
I used the term field commander. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was usually the term he used himself, commander or
yeah.
Like.
Okay, field commander. And to my surprise, and something that I would like to think about more, the fact that resettlement can serve to reinforce rather than undermine regional identities, which is usually how the way it is put in Central Asia, right? Like a dismembering of community, and that this was not actually the case in this particular context, and that I think has parallels to diaspora studies, right? Pakistanis in London and so on. So that's something interesting, I thought. And you showed how actors such as Safarov or Kanjaev used master narratives to their own end, even when they seemed kind of stupid people in some ways. Yeah, like, I mean, really, like, just having a very small world, and at the same time, they are able to pull on these strings of what makes a legitimate leader. Yeah. So that also made me think about what, how does that become possible? And as in the two other books, also, you talk about generational conflict between intellectuals and the nomenklatura. Particularly, Khalid also talks about this, and this is maybe something to highlight as a moment of violence, of intellectual rivalry between different generations, right? Being really a catalyst, having a lot of violent potential. You also give us the social roots of the IRPT, particularly in the 70s, and this is a story that actually links up to Arif Khalid's account, yeah, of Islam in Central Asia. So those books then kind of come together. There's a little gap in time, I think, but you know, you can tell that story. And in a way, you're telling us really how civil war works, and you're very engaged, I think, with Kalivas on this. I think is your main interlocutor there. And you also have an epilogue on not remembering the war and its effects and how that is done. And you call for more attention to unofficial practices of commemoration, which I think are getting more attention. And we have several people in the room here who have done lots of work on that in Central Asia, but not so much in Tajikistan. A few small points of critique. Sometimes the quotes are so long from the 25 documents that you analyze that if you were to open this book on a random page and not look at it properly, you might think that you are actually arguing what this person is saying. And sometimes I found myself I really had to read hard to see where do your words stop and where do your interlocutors or the narratives begin. Yeah. So that could be difficult for a Tajik readership, I think this might be quite hot. Yeah, if it's not read properly. And I don't know, I could have done with pictures. You gave biographies, kind of potted biographies, but this is also something that in all three books I would have liked the, fleshing out as far as it is possible, or giving me as a reader more kind of hand-holding in who is who. So I can remember Kanjaev and Nabiyev and all the rest, right? I mean, this huge portfolio of people. Where this contrasts really a lot to Timothy's story is that there's almost nothing on INGOs or sort of foreign intervention apart from the Soviet Union. So I wondered if you could comment on that, right? Because the neighboring countries undergoing conflict in contiguous periods of time, and at the same time, you are telling a different story. But I wonder if it is also, maybe you could just comment on that, the two of you. That would be really nice. Okay, Khalid, we said would be summarized by you.
Mm-hmm.
What shall we do?
Just finish, because
yeah, okay.
I'll just go with mine, even though there's some overlap with yours. I think it's easier.
So I won't summarize Khalid's work?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Or do you want me to give mine, and then, because you
not
have...
not here to complain.
No.
Do you have, like, are you have, like, critical points of engagement that needs a summary? Because I can give the summary now out of place. That's fine.
Yeah, could you?
All right. So you'll hear my introduction to my summaries afterward.
Yeah.
So I'll just jump to what I wrote about... So I make this comment about how everyone did a good job with naming their books, because the titles of their books are quite, like, they really get to the point of what the book is about. And Adib Khalid's book is called Making Uzbekistan, so it kind of says it all. So Adib Khalid's book, Making Uzbekistan, traces just that. How was Uzbekistan created? Building off of in conversation with the already substantial literature on the creation of nations in Central Asia, Khalid sets out to tell the story of Uzbekistan in a different way. In contrast to historians like Northrop or Hirsch, he aims to narrate the story from the bottom up, from the perspective of the Central Asians. Of course, I call them Central Asians and not Uzbeks, because that's part of what's being traced as their creations. He warns the reader that this might be such a different look at those of us familiar with the story that we might not even recognize it. And in some ways, he's right, but he might overstate the case there. As will be no surprise to those of us familiar with his work, Khalid takes the perspective of the Jadids and tells the story of nation dreaming and nation building from their eyes. In addition to dense historical overviews where we see the moves of Imperial Russia, the emirs, the conservative ulama, and all of their fights with the various reformers and revolutionaries, Khalid also spends a lot of time looking at life trajectories and biographies of the Jadids and the cultural productions of these early Muslim nation builders. So kind of what was the nation that they were dreaming of? He also shows us how complicated the field of actors was and the counterintuitive ways that their interests clashed or aligned. So, you know, in these kind of stereotypical readings of early Soviet history, it's not the natives versus the Soviets, obviously. There are many ways and different moments in which various groups align and clash, and those are constantly shifting as the political, economic, and kind of cultural landscape is shifting. The Jadids was, of course, a dream that was never completely realized. But Khalid takes the time to tease out their desires for nation, their wishes for a reformed, modernized Islam, and their efforts to these ends for the very narrow window of time that these people, their dream and the possibility were very much alive and well. And then, again, this is messing with the timeline of my presentation, but I went through, you'll get back to it in a minute, after I give summaries of the books. I talked a little bit about, because that's just a summary of kind of the action that takes place, but each of the authors, from my perspective, had a particular argument that they really wanted to get across, because of course one could narrate the Jadid's dream of, you know, an Uzbekistan of a reformed Islam in various ways, and Khalid's one of his particular focuses is to make the argument that this idea of nation, like a nation state, was not something solely kind of imported by the Soviets, right? And that's where he's arguing against some of the other literature, which of course took the perspective of the center. And his one of his main arguments is that the Jadids haven't had a modern notion of the nation state that they were cultivating that was very much in a global conversation with Muslims around the world. And that this was kind of an indigenous idea of the nation state and a project that they started. And that, of course, therefore, there were some moments when it was in their interest and was convenient for them to align with, let's say, a Bolshevik idea, or when, you know, they thought that this kind of revolution created a space for them to enact their particular dream. But again, that they had their own, and that it wasn't something that was necessarily imported from the outside, though, of course, always influenced by the various actors and global flows, including Soviet ones. So is that fair enough to introduce you?
Yeah. Great.
Okay.
Okay, so maybe I'll mention some of the points that I was surprised about or where he argues against.
Yeah.
So he argues against, actually, for example, the role of ethnographic knowledge or any kind of expertise in the delimitation of republics. So this is very much like the moment that Tim Epkinhans is describing, where really banal interests come to bear on a very long sort of future, right? So that things get frozen in place in a way, decisions that were made in a very haphazard way, in an extremely contingent, and, you know, nobody argued. So that's why Tajikistan becoming this residual category, a bit that nobody really wanted, and that only in retrospect found advocates for itself, and not very quite half-hearted ones. And he suggests that, you know, that we could have had something entirely different. I mean, if someone had found themselves, if there had been an elite that was interested in defending the term Sart or Kipchak, then we could have had a Sart Republic, which is a really crazy idea. But that he argues that that was a moment where that kind of thing could have been possible. This is also a history of Uzbek literature. Didn't really talk about that.
No, no.
So this is really talking about what did the belles lettres of the time do? What did they look like? And there are lots of, if you have a look at the book, there are lots of sort of literary stories in there. He really made me want to read Fitrat more, for example, or at all.
Except and for the 20 books you already read.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it? Yeah, you should just stop reading. And he argues that actually this Uzbek literature has been read on the one hand, heroizing it as a national project, right, from particularly Uzbekistani science, and on the other hand by Western scholars always looking for resistance, particularly against Soviet, and so not really actually paying attention to what this stuff is actually saying and showing, yeah? So that's what, he says this is actually an internal critique much more, yeah, and that there was for a long time the model of Ottoman, of Turkic reform and of Turkish literature, some also Persian literature, Tatar and so on, that was much more influential than anything coming from Russia until the mid-20s. Again, we have the molding of orphans as instruments of revolution and also violence. Yeah, so we have that in all three books. And like in Timothy's book, we have communists trying to make revolution where there is no proletariat. Right, so maybe, I don't know if you would like to comment on that. Do we see parallels in tactics, even though we have two totally different moments in time, almost, well, no, you know, like decades apart, in forms of violence and so on. We have, to me, it was surprising to think about the relationship between the Uzbek and the emerging Uzbek and the emerging Kazakh intelligentsia. And how they were very differently situated and therefore had different projects. I thought about comparing this to the Chinese Cultural Revolution, especially when he talks about something like the Lumpen Intelligentsia, he calls it, who attacked their forebears, their parents, as it were. And I wanted to ask really to Tim. Adib tells this sort of prehistory of Tajikistan as an arena of expulsion, of an unwantedness, but also of an already very much fracturing Persianate world, yeah, he calls it, looking at Iran and so on. So I wondered if you would like to comment on that. And he sort of defends himself, like talking about not the from the Uzbek perspective, but from the perspective of Jadids, yeah, why they are important and not this tiny minority. So he's arguing with people like Sartori and saying that, you know, he feels that some people are always looking for the authentic Central Asian, and that these modernizers are somehow not because they like to wear suits and that kind of stuff. Yeah, and, well, I mean, this is very. I'm overemphasizing this, but I think that is really the thrust of it. And he says, to me surprisingly, that the conservative ulama are silent, for example. So I thought, so what if we put Sartori, who only talks about, you know, fatwas and qazi sources and so on, can we put them together? You know, what happens then? Surely
Wait,
then something happens.
Can I come in on that
yeah.
point? Because I was laughing while she was saying this, because it had to be one of the most emotionally strong passages of the book. And it's, I think it was in the introduction somewhere, you know, where, I mean, he really comes out and you can really feel this scholarly fight between the three of them. Because it's him, Sartori, and what's his, the French? Yeah, exactly. And it's like... And sometimes I enjoy these little eruptions of fights over, you know, and it's really palpable in the text. So it's kind
of footnotes of
Stefan in some of his papers. Yeah, exactly. So I have to say I quite enjoyed it, and you can see that there is this sense of like overmaking your case, because, you know, rather than saying, can we put them together? Can, you know, probably, like you said, aren't these, this was all happening at the same time. These are people who all had voices. There's very much an, yeah. So it was fun.
Mine come first.
Yeah.
Resources.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I have a few points of comparison that I would like to pull out. Is that okay? And then I'll stop.
Sure.
Yeah. So, Tim. So there is talk of Tajikistan in the Afghan book and talk of Afghanistan in the Tajik book, but it's quite sidelined. So I wanted to ask if you would like to foreground that more. And there's also stories of borders. So there we could bring in Botakos, right? So you have talked about exactly this border. So I wondered, you know, how would you three tell that story together, maybe? There's also a link to Magnus Marsden's book. For example, in Timothy's book, you talk about this trading dynasty of Bharats, yeah, which have a very particular relationship to the Soviet ways of doing things. I wanted to ask a historian's question, kind of as an anthropologist, like, you know, the impact of your sources, the languages you speak, whether you go first to the Moscow archives or first to Tashkent or something, whether you consider oral archives as well, or informal archives, Timothy did for MSF. In what sense do your competencies and your training determine your view, do you think? I don't think anthropologists in the same way have an equivalent kind of material conditions of knowledge in the same way. And I really feel this very strongly in Central Asia, particularly when I work with historians of the Soviet Union who don't focus on Central Asia, right? This view from Moscow is so different and so dismissive, really, of any other kind of source code sometimes. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on that. violence, so you have this kind of, these contingencies, and that means that, you know, if you take about away one element, or if you have a better leader or something, that means that things could have looked really different and maybe better. So, and this is counterfactual history, but at the same time, I feel like in that context, if you are arguing for all this contingency, yeah, then that might be an interesting thing to think about. How does this story travel? So you really kept your stories to your places. What does it mean for the rest of the world? How did the mess in Afghanistan affect the world, right? Timothy, you talk more about how the mess in the world affected Afghanistan, yeah? And what does it teach us about late central, sort of late 20th century and early 21st century warfare as such? Yeah. And as a last note, I wanted to talk about theory again. I think in these books there's lots of theory. I mentioned this particularly for Timothy, but it's true all of them, and it's implicit. And I feel a little bit of shift in what theory does, and I'm not sure how to describe that. So I was actually quite relieved, Timothy, that you didn't talk about these kind of constellations of ideas and so on as assemblages, which pretty much everyone does now. Like, because that term is one that kind of reaches out and never arrives anywhere, really, right? So so you could have written your book in that vein and you didn't, you resisted that. And at the same time, you know, if theory is so implicit, that's also sort of problematic. Not so much in Nadib Khalid's book, but... especially in yours, actually, but there's a kind of there's something there, and I don't know how to formulate. Not in yours.
No.
Yeah. So it's about how this stuff travels, really, whether it's the story or the effect of the actual events or the what you're proposing. Yeah, I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Okay.
Okay, so some of what I have to say will be a little bit repetitive, but I think we each have our own kind of interest. So I'll just go as I planned it, and well, so. Anyway, the organizers couldn't have been more right when they chose the title of Nation for this panel. Though they suggested the titles were merely things to think with, and that we could, of course, venture out on our own to find other connections, I can think of no better connection than the idea of nation. The three books, each in their own way, tell a story of nation. A nation desired, a nation in collapse, a nation thwarted before it ever got started, a nation doomed to failure. Now, you guess which one of those is, you know, each of the stories tells, but the fact is they all tell a bit of all of them. They tell the story of nation across the broad reach of the 20th century, and unfortunately, in all cases, this is a story of violence, loss, and tragedy. Each of the authors likewise tells a story that they present is one that's already well known, so each of the authors somewhat recognizes that the story is something we all know, but they all argue that the tale that they're bringing, or they intimate that the tale they're bringing is told through a different perspective or in a different way, and I think that they all succeed in that endeavor. So you can already get a hint of what that was through Jean's summaries. So anyway, so now I have my little summary of each of them. As I said already, the titles I thought were all really apt. They kind of summarize. I'm bad with titles, so I always like when people's titles are apt and do their job. And I'll start with Tim's, which of course is called The Origins of the Civil War in Tajikistan, and that's exactly what he talks about. Tim's aim is to construct a narrative of the Civil War, building up... What in the world did I write? Oh... I've completely messed up my sentence here. But anyway, he constructs a narrative of the lead up to the Civil War based on the memoirs of some of its primary political actors. In this way, he presents a person-centered narrative of conflict that until now has been told in more traditional terms. Through Tim's narrative, we see the conflict as it emerged from the perspective of these individuals. We see their varying perspectives, their personal prejudices, their flaccid or egocentric characters, and even their drinking habits. We see them make alliances and break them, set each other up, and in one passage, they, you know, I don't know if they killed each other, if their bodyguards killed each other, but two men walked in a room and no one left. Tim paints us a picture not of inevitability, but of an emerging contingent moments that led to a horrible civil war. I'm not skilled enough to kind of recount all these, you know, all the various kind of machinations and backroom deals and this and that, and all the various characters that were involved. But Tim does a very good job of leading us through that. And what he does so well is to show the variety of alliances that were involved and the various registers of belonging that were important to people during the lead up to the Civil War and eventually during the Civil War. And he shows how complicated the various groupings of people were in this conflict. He brings the role of criminal networks, trade-based networks, in addition to more classically understood regional, political, or religious groupings of actors who were involved in the war. He highlights how at the height of the war, it was really unclear and nearly impossible for the majority of Tajikistanis to know actually who a particular group of violent people was and if they were fighting for something in particular, did they have a political cause or not, or what was their aim and their violence, what were they trying to achieve. And I thought, for me, that was one of the most enlightening things to read was how... in a sense, a little bit chaotic. A lot of this was and must have been for the victims. You know, but the story is told largely about the primary actors involved, but there was a sense of how chaotic all of this was for the victims, not really always knowing what was going on, who was attacking whom, for what end, whether in the short term or the long term. So then I moved on to the summary of Deep Khalid's book, which I won't reread for you, but that's also a story. You know, I mean, Tim's is one of kind of nation in disintegration, but while it's in disintegrating, he narrates the various visions that people are trying to enact as they kind of look at what should Tajikistan be after the collapse of the Soviet Union. In that way, Khalid's book is also this kind of idea of the various narrations of nation that are happening at the moment of revolution leading up to the Soviet Union. So in both of them, we have this nice kind of mix of the variety of ideas and the kind of inevitability of the Soviet Union or the post-Soviet world is suspended for a moment in these two very close-up looks. So then to move on to Timothy's book, he gives us a history of Afghanistan that's also told through different eyes than the typical narration. While Khalid's book is resolutely about a particular slice of the local population dreaming of nationhood, the intellectuals and the revolutionary modernists, Timothy's story is the story of dreamers on the outside, the international community and their desire for constructing or modernizing Afghanistan. He starts where many of us feel most at home in the scholarly world, and he investigates, and the title of that chapter is How to Write a History of Afghanistan, where he largely looks at Soviet-era scholarship on the region, including the frames of interpretation. He also begins to set out some of the concepts, questions, and frames at play in kind of the whole global story of the 20th century Afghanistan, things which, by the way, I really don't know anything about, but the Durand Line, the idea of Pashtun nationalism, how well scholars really know a place and whether or not and to what extent they have any ability to kind of influence policymaking. And this is something that, you know, we addressed yesterday in our discussion. And so, you know, he lays that out for us. And then from there, he moves on through his book, narrating a history of development projects in Afghanistan. Finance and water reform by the Americans, oil and gas and gender equality by the Soviets, and wood, kind of wood and forestry by the Germans, to name a few of the examples. In each case, we see the various ways Afghanistan was situated in the Cold War, the ways it was bound up in global networks of development intervention, and the way it became their object. But also the various commonalities of the logics behind these modernizing schemes. So while he draws out differences between something like a particular Soviet intervention and American intervention, he's also careful to draw out what was similar in two of those, and you know, and what kind of similar logics did they draw from. Above all, we see the hubris of the intervening nations and their failure to do their homework. In this way, it's a classical failure of development. Timothy also shows the rise of a new kind of development intervention, the individual rights-bearing, suffering subject, and the death of an older type of, or what he describes as a death of the older type of a development intervention, which is that based on the nation state as kind of the locus for the intervention. Each of them, like I said, each of the books has, in addition to kind of this narration, has a particular argument that they want to make. For me, Tim's seem to be, they all are a little bit of an anti-argument. Tim seemed to me to be arguing against what I'm sure is a body of literature on the Civil War that's very deterministic in nature. He talks against things like these frames of tribalism or religious extremism as kind of an overarching, brush or this broad stroke of why the Civil War broke out, which is why he is constantly highlighting the shifting nature of people's alliances, even within a particular, let's say, political moment where people were agreeing, how they split apart later. And that's one of his primary aims, is to show the contingency of all of this. And he's careful to work out things like what role did Islam play or not? What role did discourses of Islamic extremism play in creating, you know, or labeling enemies? Something we both have worked on in both of our researches. So that was something that I think he was really trying to get across. It was not this, you know, monolithic kind of predetermined entities, but this was a very contingent, evolving political structure that was sometimes really personal as well. And again, to highlight, he brought in these other actors like the kind of organized crime, youth gangs, which are often left out of the analysis. I think one of the things I appreciated the argument of contingency. I think it would have been nice to work it out a little bit more in the introduction. Because you present it as not only kind of a word that you use to describe an empirical situation, like this was contingent, but you almost present it as a theoretical idea, and I wanted you to go a bit further. I completely buy your argument, but I wanted you to flesh it out. I think Adib Khalid, one of the things that, like I already said, that he was trying to get across is this idea of the nation state and national identity as a modern phenomena was not something that was, you know, only Bolshevik in nature or brought by the Soviets, but something that was already, let's say, present in the Jadids in Central Asia in the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, but also was a very international, global idea that was circulating, in this case, among Muslims who had a particular vision of Islam and the nation. And that, so there was, you know, local roots as well as, let's say, Russian roots to the national kind of movement towards a nation state. So that was his main point. And for me, one of Timothy's main points was this, and this is what Jean talked about as well in her summary, was that this idea of territoriality and the failure of many development projects in Afghanistan because they were premised on this idea of a kind of territorial delineated, culturally unified nation state that didn't really map on well to the actual movement of politics or concepts of belonging in Afghanistan at the moment that they were enacted. So there was this mismatch and that things tended to fail. And then he also wants to chart this kind of emerging other sense of development, which is not through the nation state, but exactly through kind of individual rights-bearing, suffering people. And that's the move towards, and he traces that through things like Doctors Without Borders and the way that they, you know, kind of move from one type of intervention to the one that they operate in now. I liked this and I agreed with you. But the one thing I wanted you to do to make it a little bit more complicated was not to forget, I think I have the tendency, I recognize something in your writing that I recognize in myself, in wanting to make a particular point that's kind of missing the literature, sometimes you go a tiny bit too far. And I thought, in some cases, for example, when you were talking about the Soviet project or the various Soviet projects which premised this idea of the nation state, sometimes the fact that the at least the ideology of the Soviet Union as an international, as a global movement, got a little bit pushed down in order to make your point about the basic idea of development as happening through the nation state, which again I buy, but which I still wanted you to complicate. And then on the other side, of course, that the international NGO which premises, or the contemporary international organization which premises this individual rights-bearing, suffering subject, are also still often, though global, rooted in certain national locations, national cultures, and national discourses. So I think you could have just kind of made that a little bit more complicated, but those were the main arguments. There's all kinds of points of overlap, and I'll just name some of them and not really go into them, but I think that all the authors struggle with or premise and work with the idea of coloniality or post-coloniality, very different. I think if we would set Khalid's book and Tim's book next to each other, they have a really different approach. Tim's is partly motivated by the fact that his interlocutors seem to speak of the Soviet Union as a colony and what they were doing as post-colonial, where we obviously know Adib Khalid's stance, which he continues in the way that he has in his earlier writings, that he doesn't see the Soviet Union as a colony. I mean, it's its own power, a sort of power, and he's strong to make that point. So that's an interesting conversation. Let me see. I think all the books are interesting in that they discuss the idea of Islam and being Muslim as connected to national projects. And I think there are complementary ways in which they do that. That's something really strong in my own work. So that's obviously something that I paid attention to. They all, even though Khalid's book is presented as an argument from below, which it is, if you take the Soviets in Moscow as the center, then this is the periphery. But yet all three stories are told by the voices of elite men. I understand this, or from what I can imagine from the records that you're working with, there's probably not much else out there to get. And I think each one of the authors does their best to highlight and to bring in female voices when they're there, and women who are acting when they can find them. But it is very much a story of men. And what's interesting is in all the stories, you know, so we're spanning the 20th century in one way or the other, and we're talking about nation, and all of these women are objects of the nation building in various ways, whether it's in Tim's story where women are being raped and sexually abused, or the fear of that is motivating different groups. Khalid wrote about some things that the Jadids and the Bolsheviks, arguments they were making about marriage, which are still occurring by international organizations in Kyrgyzstan, the exact same arguments. I'm doing research on marriage, and I thought, oh, yeah, this is almost the same language that's being used today. And of course, we all know through all kinds of research that's been done about women in Afghanistan that they that kind of this modernization or development of Afghanistan has often turned around the idea of women as objects and where they need to be in terms of a nation in development. So that's something that's interesting in all of their work. I do thank Tim for taking seriously this idea of manliness, and I think that in gender studies that's something we need to explore and to understand better, and that's something that all of you men in the room can do better than us women. So I encourage all of you to continue to explore that, because gender and gender politics are important in all of these stories, and we often get the women's side from women, but men can bring us the idea of, you know, how does something like being a man play a role in or ideas about being a proper man play a role in these projects of nation. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you. So actually, so much has been said in these two presentations that there's not that much left for me to say. No, but this is good. This is perfect, because unlike Jean and Julie, I feel I haven't quite woken up yet. So, and the double espresso that I just had is just not enough. I would need like three of those, I guess. I'm definitely not going to give another summary of the three books. I think that would be redundant. Also because the two discussions that we've just had, I think, have really covered a lot of ground quite comprehensively. So I think my comments are going to be, first of all, extremely brief, but also different in the sense that I'm going to try to highlight two very general points of a comparison and kind of two general points of reflection that go, I think, way beyond these specific books. One is something that Julie has already mentioned. I was actually quite frightened when you got to that point, because I thought, okay, now this leaves really not much for me to say.
I just skipped right over it.
Yeah, and this is the point about post-coloniality. All three books tell us stories of different moments, or possibly I could also say different kinds of post-coloniality. Two of these moments of post-coloniality are almost contemporaneous with each other. In Timothy's book, Afghanistan becoming, as I think I said also yesterday, referring to his book, a post-colony avant la lettre, or as Timothy puts it in his book, before it became fashionable. Roughly at the same time, the area of Central Asia, which was later to become Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, is also becoming a sort of a post-colony. However, these are two different kinds of post-colony. Largely, though I'm not saying that this explains it all, but largely because they had been parts of different empires. It makes a difference for these two contemporaneous post-colonies, or perhaps we should say pre-post-colonies, that one had been a part of Russia and the other had been part of the British empire's sphere of influence. And then Tajikistan, in Tim's narrative, becomes a post-colony again, I would say for a second time at least, in the 1990s, or beginning perhaps in the late 1980s, right? So these are very different moments for a post-colony to emerge, and very different circumstances. However, why I think it does make sense to call all these moments, and you know, all three moments are actually quite different from what we usually think of post-colony, right? Historically speaking, because these are not post-colonies that emerge in the wake of World War II, right? These are not post-colonies that emerge in the 1950s and the 1960s. But I still think that it makes sense to speak of all these three moments as post-colonial, because these are all situations in which we have various local and not only local groups groping and trying to come up with viable concepts of of the nation, of statehood and national sovereignty, right? We know what these groups are. We have these warlords in Thames and kind of, you know, politicians and field commanders in Thames' book. We have the Jadids in Adib's book, and we have mostly the foreign actors in Timothy's narrative. And I think obviously this last point makes Timothy's narrative a little bit different, because here we largely have outside actors competing over concepts of sovereignty and statehood for Afghanistan, right? But still, I think the post-colonial element is there, if we define post-coloniality by that situation in which various groups strive to come up with, as I said, a viable concept of, a viable notion of nationhood, of statehood, of sovereignty, variously dealing with the presence or sometimes the absence of previously established patterns, practices, discourses, meanings, symbols, right? We have this very contingent landscape of half-ruined past practices and meanings. And it's that landscape that defines the situation in which the various actors have to navigate, struggling to build something new, partly through bricolage, partly through invention, partly through external borrowing of ideas and practices, right? That would be a generalized condition that I think we could gloss as post-coloniality, and that's something that I think we can see in all three moments described by these books. However, this also means that we need to probably rethink what we mean by post-coloniality, because at the very least, and I think we can, this is something that we can possibly discuss later. I don't really have very specific ideas about this, but at the very least, when these three books are read together and through this lens, I think what they reveal is that post-coloniality is at the same time much more generalized and at the same time much more variegated a condition than we usually think of. Right, post-coloniality, it seems, happens much more often, but it also happens in many more ways than we usually think it does, I guess. So that would be. I'm not sure if anything of this is clear, but I hope it is. So that would be my point about post-coloniality, and the other thing is democracy. And here I'm going to address Timothy and Tim more than Adib, not only because Adib is not with us, but also because I think this theme of democracy is kind of more pertinent and more relevant to other books, but in different ways. In Tim's narrative, Tim's narrative provoked me, so to speak, to reflect on whether democracy is, as Gayatri Spivak put it, something one cannot not want, right? I think one of the fascinating parts of Tim's book is how the very notion of democracy, the very value of democracy, was actually contested and rejected by a number of actors in Tajikistan. I don't have the exact quotes with me right now, but some of the quotations from the sources were actually quite striking, where democracy was used as a pejorative term by some of those field commanders. And that's, you know, that's so different than usual, right? That flipped me over, but, you know, it flipped me over in a good way.
I mean, it's also the case in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It's a bad word to use the word democracy.
Yeah. So, you know, so basically I think maybe you could have even kind of worked this out a little bit more to kind of make this even more explicit. That would have made your book even stronger than it is, I think, if that was kind of brought to light more. Because it's there in the sources, but, you know, maybe you could have even made more use of this emerging point. Whereas sometimes I did get the impression that's one of the very few points of criticism that I have with regard to your book is that sometimes I did have the impression that implicitly you sort of seem to adopt a fairly normative, unreflexive concept of democracy. At some point you're speaking of, and this is a quote, although I do not remember the page number, an open civil society as defining democracy, which kind of strikes me as a little bit, you know, banal and normative and you know, whereas the sources actually invite much more critical reflection on the vernacular meanings and values of democracy in that very interesting context, right? In turn, in Timothy's book, I think democracy is conspicuous by its absence. This morning I just checked the index in Timothy's book, and democracy does not even have an entry in the index, which might mean that it's just all over the book, right? But it's not. And I think this is fascinating, that, you know, even when you have those in transnational NGOs trying to build, or Elia, you have the mostly American modernizers, right? There's a lot of talk about the free market, some talk of civil society, especially in the latter phase when you have like post-war, when you have those transnational NGOs. Yeah, but there's, I mean, basically democracy is not even an issue, right? And because of how Timothy has decided to construct his book, which I think there's great value to it, this is not a point of criticism, we learn a lot about outside perspectives on Afghanistan from Timothy's book, but we do not really hear many local voices. And as I'm saying, this is not a point of criticism, this is just a statement of fact. However, it might have been very interesting to see what local actors might have had to say about democracy, right? And about democracy as a value, as an ideal, about, was it something that they would, like Julie just said, reject and criticize, well, reject more than criticize, I gather, in a similar way as some of the actors in Tim's book did, or perhaps to some of them it was something that one cannot not want, as Spivak has it, right? Yeah, that's more or less all I got. Thank you.